Hello, this is Al Reynolds from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall share with you the Triangle Business Journal, dated March 13th, 2015. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This week's cover story, Wanted, Higher Paying Jobs. This column is written by Jason DeBrun. Ed Cook will never forget, 9 a.m. Monday, January 12, 2015. It rained heavily in Raleigh that day, and a layer of fog hung over the city, but the weather isn't why that day stands out to Cook. January 12 was the day he learned he was being laid off. Cook worked as a manager in the IT department for a financial institution. He declined to say which one. He worked as a full-time employee for nearly a dozen years and as a contractor for the 4 years prior to that. He made as much as $125,000 per year, a comfortable living. On that rainy morning, it all went away. Cook's story, of course, isn't unique. Even as the North Carolina economy sputters back to life, layoffs persist, and a new fear has spread through the workforce. Even as North Carolinians and Americans in general get back to work, the work they find pays them less. A Triangle Business Journal analysis of the labor data obtained from North Carolina state officials paints a picture of a state producing more jobs in lower-paying industries than the more desired higher-paying ones. From the 21 primary industries tracked by the Labor Department, 15 industries have created jobs in the past 7 years that pay less than $43,000 annually. North Carolina estimates the mean annual wage for all industries to be $42,420. While most of the industries now employ more people since the pre-recession levels, wages for hundreds of thousands of workers across the Tar Heel State have gone the other way, and that, to experts, is a state with a depleting middle class. It's a reality all too familiar for Cook and the thousands of workers like him. My wife already has part-time work as a tutor, and she is considering taking on more, Cook says. Having managed up to 25 software developers and suddenly facing possibly stocking shelves is somewhat concerning. The potential wage reduction Cook faces is all too real for many workers. Governor Pat McCrory and leaders in the North Carolina Commerce Department tout the declining unemployment rate. Indeed, the rate dropped to 5.5% in December, down from 7.5% just 1 year prior, and as high as 11.3% during the worst of the recession. But many of those jobs don't pay very much. The trend in North Carolina is clear. The economy has added an imbalance of jobs, with those paying smaller wages increasingly tipping the scales. Consider that for management occupations, the classification with the highest average wage, North Carolina today has 20,000 fewer jobs than in 2008. Even to get at 2006 levels, North Carolina would still need to add nearly 8,000 more managers. Compare that to the two categories with the lowest average wages, personal care and service organizations, and food preparation and serving-related occupations. In those categories, the North Carolina economy has added 64,000 jobs, a 16% increase since 2006. This should concern everyone, not just those in the low-paying jobs. If more people gain less disposable income, they must cut out discretionary spending. That means fewer trips to the movies, bad for theater owners, fewer vacations, bad for tourism in North Carolina, fewer date nights, bad for the hospitality business, and so on. Economists have taken to calling the recovery an unbalanced recovery or a low-wage recovery. Much like many states across the nation, wages have not kept up with inflation in North Carolina. The median income for all earners in 2011 was $31,093. In order to simply keep up with inflation, that salary should have increased to $33,185 by 2014. Instead, it increased only to $32,100, a 3% difference. That means that thousands of workers have spending power of roughly $1,000 less than 4 years ago. This is something that we should be concerned with, says Bill Lester, an assistant professor at UNC Chapel Hill's City and Regional Planning Department and an expert on the impact of minimum wage and living wage policies on urban economic development. Although the recovery has so far been unbalanced, it doesn't have to continue this way, Lester says. Strategic state incentives can keep North Carolina competitive in the jobs market. Unfortunately, many of the solutions require a long-term vision, something for which politicians don't seem to carry a strong appetite. Lester advocates for a minimum wage increase to $10.10, something that would give 700,000 North Carolinians an immediate raise, although acknowledges that that's a high mountain to climb, politically speaking. He also recommends spending on education at all levels and on organizations like the North Carolina Biotechnology Center, which uses tax dollars to pump angel investments into the life sciences startups. These investments, however, can take years to bloom, unlike an incentives package to lure a company to expand here, which comes with a more direct cause and effect correlation. In the short run, it's difficult to see those things working, Lester says. It's a little difficult to see the immediate effect. Still, training a workforce to meet the needs of employers is crucial. Companies nationwide complain that they cannot find talented workers. Lester says there could be a combination of incentives. Instead of simply giving tax breaks to a company, offer a state-sponsored training program. That way, it wouldn't cost the company any additional funds to train workers, but they would get the qualified workforce. Additionally, North Carolina would gain workers with more training. But it's an incredibly difficult challenge, Lester concedes. At least one other North Carolina group has started tracking the distribution of wages and the demographics of a worker, the results of which may soon be in front of the General Assembly as lawmakers try to mitigate the need for corporate incentives programs and depleting tax coffers. An analysis by a group in the UNC Chapel Hill School of Government finds that 31% of all workers in North Carolina work in low-wage jobs. The group defined low wage as those making at most $11.34 per hour or 150% of the federal poverty level. Even more concerning, the group found that it isn't just young workers skewing the numbers. The proportion of young low-wage workers is indeed much higher for that group, 90% or more for 17, 18, and 19-year-old workers. But even for workers in their 30s, 40s, and 50s, at least one-fifth of the workers in each of these age cohorts are working in low-wage jobs, according to this report. These numbers match trends at the national level. While the economy lost 3.6 million jobs in higher-wage industries and 3.2 million jobs in middle-wage industries, it added back only 2.6 million high-wage jobs and 2.3 million middle-wage jobs, according to the National Employment Law Project, which analyzed Bureau of Labor Statistics data. Conversely, the economy lost 2 million low-wage jobs but has added back 3.8 million in that category. These jobs will contribute to a declining unemployment rate but don't tell the whole story of the economic recovery. We find that low-wage job creation was not simply a characteristic of the first phase of the recovery, but rather a pattern that has persisted for more than 4 years now, according to the report's author, Annette Bernhardt. Deep into the recovery, job growth is still heavily concentrated in lower-wage industries. A result of unbalanced employment growth, the types of jobs available to unemployed workers, new labor market entrants, and individuals looking to move up the career ladder are distinctly different today than they were prior to the recession. In some respects, the imbalanced recovery serves as a sort of market correction. In the run-up to 2008, the housing boom pumped jet fuel into the economy. It's created thousands of construction jobs, well-paying jobs for workers without college education, and thousands of mortgage or finance jobs, well-paying jobs for workers with a college education. One could argue, however, that those jobs should never have existed in the first place. We're probably never going to see the same kind of job opportunities in the finance industry, says Alec Levinson, a labor expert at University of Southern California Center for Effective Organizations, part of the USC Marshall School of Business. Partly because of the new federal banking regulations, financial institutions cut back on risk-taking. Levinson argues that that's good for the economy as a whole, but impacts individual workers. They disappeared because they never should have been there in the first place, he says. A better comparison, according to Levinson, would be to roughly 2004 before speculation ran rampant. In some ways, we're almost there again. In North Carolina, as in the United States, workers have long been shifting from manufacturing jobs to service jobs. While that divide hit overdrive in 2008, it wasn't a new phenomenon. From the beginning of 2008 to the end of 2014, North Carolina saw goods-producing jobs decline by 18%. In the same time, service-providing jobs increased by 7%, according to figures from the North Carolina Department of Commerce. To be sure, Levinson points out that the shift doesn't necessarily correlate with wages. We used to talk about high-wage manufacturing, low-wage service, Levinson says. That wasn't really true back then, but it's certainly not true now. There are lots of services, yes, restaurant, grocery, but also professional services, working in technology, and some of that can be very high-paying. That said, as technology improves and as the world becomes ever smaller, those service jobs are increasingly in much danger of being shipped overseas like manufacturing jobs. With the internet and worldwide interconnectedness, a manager in Raleigh can easily give a tax preparation assignment to a worker in Bangalore to complete, possibly for a lower wage than the manager would pay to a worker here. Although it sped the process up, the recession should not receive exclusive blame. A few decades ago, workers could find good work with a high school diploma and great work with a college degree. That might have kicked up one rung in which workers find good jobs with a college degree and great ones with a graduate degree. It used to be that if you graduated with a bachelor's degree in anything, you could find a reasonable job and make a career out of it. That's becoming harder to do, says Levinson. That has also contributed to interrupted careers where workers would spend 10 years in one career but then shift to something completely different. Back at his home, Cook hasn't given up on finding good work. A program at Wake Tech called HRD, Human Resources Development, offers courses to provide employable skills training and assistance for adults looking for work, transitioning back into the workforce, or working to define their professional niche. These programs have grown up in popularity and helped place laid-off workers in good jobs. Cook feels like he has benefited from the resources at Wake Tech to modernize his job search, but he had to learn new strategies. Resumes in the 21st century are not like they used to be, he says. Next up, Amanda Hoyle. Amanda Hoyle's column covers commercial and residential real estate. Fitness price tag, $28 million. The Minnesota company opens a 108,000-square-foot facility in Raleigh. On March 10th, Lifetime Fitness, the Minnesota-based health club company, opened its second mega-gym facility in the Triangle with a $28 million campus on Falls of the Noose Road in North Raleigh. But Lifetime General Manager Derek Neru cringes at the word gym to describe the members-only club. Gyms are usually dirty. The equipment is broken and it smells. A club is a destination spot. You could spend the whole day here, he says. The two-story, 108,000-square-foot building does have a well-stocked fitness area with multiple fitness studios for its 88 class offerings each week. But it also has its own spa, hair salon, cafe, full-size basketball courts, both indoor and outdoor resort-style swimming pool and aquatic center, and a kids' academy for children. The club also plans to open in the spring its first ever Lifetime outdoor circuit with a half-mile loop for biking and running, along with fitness stations, turf space, and stairs. Lifetime Fitness has also a gold-level health club in Cary that opened in 2006 and three other smaller gym facilities in Raleigh and in Apex. The new Falls of the Noose Club, though, is its premium-branded Lifetime Athletic Club in the state. The Raleigh Club employs 288 people. Big deals were busy in February. $169 million in Triangle commercial properties were sold. $127 million for the Lenovo Enterprise Campus on Development Drive in Research Triangle Park. $22 million for the Embassy Suites Hotel on Creedmoor Road in Raleigh. $11.9 million for three retail buildings leased to Walgreens, Sheets, and Advance Auto. And $7.8 million for the 2605 Meridian Parkway office building in Durham. And on the Centennial Campus, a non-wovens institute is to anchor a new North Carolina State University research facility. NC State is finalizing a plan with Raleigh real estate developer Keystone Corporation to build a new $28 million research facility at Centennial Campus that will be anchored by the non-wovens institute. Construction of the yet-to-be-named 105,000-square-foot building is expected to begin by May, with completion in early summer 2016, says Jim Little, Chief Operating Officer at Keystone. The building's original intent was to create space for the specialized textile equipment that had been donated to or purchased by the Institute for its non-wovens research, a piece of which requires a ceiling height of at least 50 feet, or the equivalency of a three-story building. The university will be leasing 44,644 square feet inside the building on behalf of the Nonwovens Institute and other campus groups. That leaves about 60,000 square feet of office, lab, and research space that will be available to lease to other Centennial Campus partner companies. The building will also have its own fourth-level 240-space parking deck that will have a bridge connecting to the building, says Brian DiDano of Danis Construction Company, the general contractor for the project. This week's column by Jason DeBrun covers healthcare and biopharmaceuticals. And he'd like to know, will patents lead to funding? Flag Therapeutics hopes to snag new investors. Raleigh Cancer drug developer Flag Therapeutics received a key patent, but is still slogging through the tough task that every early-stage drug developer faces, raising money. The fundraising has been grueling, says Greg Davis, co-founder of the Flag. Early-stage pharma is called the Valley of Death, and we are certainly struggling to get through that. The most recent round of awarded patents could help push Flag through that valley. Flag received what is called a composition of matter patent, what is seen as the holy grail among the categories of patents. Importantly, the patent covers Flag's lead compound through 2031, so we have a nice long runway to fully develop that compound, Davis says. It's a pretty big deal. This brings Flag's intellectual property portfolio to 28 issued and 26 filed patents for their oncology pipeline. We look forward to advancing our drugs to provide life-saving treatment for patients who desperately need improved therapies, says Flag co-founder and CEO Frank Sorgi. It's not as if Flag has been operating with no money. The North Carolina Biotechnology Center awarded Flag a $50,000 company inception loan in March last year, and Flag qualifies for more financing from the Biotech Center, which receives taxpayer money to fund small life sciences startups in hopes that they can leverage the small amounts into larger outside capital. Davis says that the Biotech Center money should be enough to allow Flag to run more tests on its compounds and bring data, hopefully promising, to larger investment groups. Some venture groups have expressed interest, but none have stepped forward to be lead investor. The investment group that would negotiate the terms, though Davis says other investors have said they would join if Flag finds a lead investor. We've got some irons in the fire that we are hopeful about, Davis says. In the pharma corner, Patheon acquisition targets better drug absorption rates. Drug-based Patheon has acquired Oregon-based Agir Pharmaceuticals in a move aimed at improving Patheon's ability to manufacture drugs with better absorption rates. When patients take drugs by any method except intravenously, the absorption rate into the body is less than 100% because the body will digest a portion of the drug and discard it as waste. Drug developers must account for this when deciding how much active drug to dose in a pill or capsule in order to deliver the right amount to the end user. Patheon helps drug companies develop and manufacture these pills and capsules and says it will now better be able to help its customers, those drug developers, reach an optimal dosage. Most drugs are soluble, but there are certain drugs that present challenges and need some modified delivery technology. This is what Agir brings to the table. Heat biologic stock going up, down following FDA stock news. Durham's Heat Biologics saw its stock pop more than 35% at one point on March 9th after it announced it received fast-track designation from the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. The designation means the FDA will work more closely with Heat and allow the company to move its drug through the development faster, ideally meaning the company can begin selling the drug much sooner than without the designation. But the stock started falling March 10th when the company announced it was floating $10 million in new shares. Next up, Lauren Onisorge. Lauren covers technology and entrepreneurship, and she leads this week's column with Steels Builds More Marketing Momentum. Raleigh social media marketing startup Steels is growing an audience, raising cash, and adding big-name clients. Co-founder Jim Zidnar says Steels, which has gone from 7 employees last year to more than double that in a suite at HQ Raleigh, has developed a mobile app that aims to turn customers into brand ambassadors. App users are rewarded for sharing photos during their visit to one of Steel's partner establishments, with prizes such as discounts and free food. Users can share photos on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter, advertising their experience. Already, the firm has secured and launched pilot programs at restaurants under several household brand banners: McDonald's, Applebee's, Denny's, Zaxby's, Arby's, Bojangles, Witch Witch, Another Broken Egg Cafe, Dairy Queen, Smoothie King, Cold Stone Creamery, and more. And the company inked its first international client, Guatemala-based restaurant Brick House. "We are signing up 3 new customers a day," Zidar says. "A lot of them are just referrals from other business owners." Current clients keep doubling down. Take McDonald's, which started out testing Steels in just 2 stores. Today, the app is in 56 McDonald's restaurants in 5 states. "It's all about social reach," says Julie Barbiero, communication supervisor for McDonald's Corporation. "Steels gives so much visibility to our brand and really helps individual stores reach existing and potential customers in a way that is organic and authentic." Reach is exactly what McDonald's and restaurants like it need. The burger giant has struggled with declining sales, posting a 2% revenue decrease in January and restructuring its management team, a move that impacted 51 positions at a Raleigh corporate office. Steele's job, Zidar says, is to come at a restaurant marketing with a new approach, and brands are starting to catch on. "It took us a year to get the company going," he says. The company's momentum picked up when Zidar connected with local angel investor David Gardner. That introduction facilitated contacts that's helped Zidar's firm go from begging restaurateurs to fielding calls from household brands. It's surreal to Zidar, who, while the company was struggling, says he spent the night in a car for 45 days straight. "I think everyone knows the challenges, the sacrifices you make," he says. "People say you need a work-life balance. I think that's overrated. What do you have to lose?" Zidar says he expects to close on a $1 million bridge round at the end of March, which would put the firm at $1.6 million in funds raised. Its most recent funding was $400,000 from investors, including Gardner. Money news in the technology sector. North Carolina breaks $1 billion mark with 2014 investments in multiple sectors. Over the past 2 years, the state's entrepreneurial companies have raised more than $1 billion in funding. That's according to new data released by CED that shows 226 entrepreneurial companies raised cash in 2014. The companies collectively raised more than $622 million in funding through equity investments, grants, and awards. Compare that to the $461 million raised by 223 companies in 2013. A total of 331 investments were made in the state in 2014, up 27% from the 260 deals for North Carolina companies in 2013. Where the cash went? Tech companies, $278 million in funding for 2014, up from $117 million in 2013. The highest deal, Dude Solutions, $100 million investment. Advanced Manufacturing and Materials, $81 million in funding for 2014, up from $69 million in 2013. Highest deal, Phoenics, $44 million investment. And finally, life sciences firms, more than $252 million in 2014. That's down from $275 million in 2013. And that highest deal was Viamet Pharmaceuticals, $60 million investment. I beg your pardon, that isn't the last one. The last one is clean tech companies, nearly $11 million in 2014. And there are no figures for 2013. Where did the cash come from? Here are the numbers. 41 investors came from the Southeast. 32 investors came from North Carolina. 28 investors came from the Northeast. 21 investors came from the Mid-Atlantic. 20 investors came from California. 12 investors came from the Midwest. 2 investors came from the Northwest. And 8 investors came from abroad, the UK, Ireland, Belgium, Germany, France, and China. Lauren Onisorge also follows things that are happening at the airport. And the experts handicap RDU's effort to lure new international flights. Margins are minuscule at best when adding international flights, experts warn. But the benefits, think a $1.4 billion GDP infusion per flight over a 25-year period, are big. At a regional transportation alliance-sponsored forum on March 10th, experts weighed the challenges. They say new technology and competitive tax policies could improve the margins. The real issue is, who's going to be on that airplane? Peter Bilobaba, principal research scientist at MIT, questioning the methodology behind decisions to bring in new international flights. And John Heimlich is quoted as saying, you really have to compete to make yourselves that next best opportunity. He is the vice president and chief economist for Airlines for America, who say air carriers are growing. This week's executive voice is Mrs. Michelle Rich Good. Mrs. Good is the owner of the Rich Commercial Realty in Raleigh. Pardon me, she is the president. It was founded in November of 1989. Her husband is Lloyd Good. She's been married for 18 years. She's from Garland, North Carolina, and her education includes a bachelor's degree from Meredith College and a master's degree from ECU. When Triangle Business Journal asked her, what was your first job? she replied, packing blueberries at White Lake. I was in the eighth grade and made 10 cents for every 12 pints I packed. They'd put the berries on a conveyor belt and we'd pull the stems off, separate out the red and green ones, put on a plastic cover and a rubber band, and put it on the flat. In 6 weeks, I think I made $90, which was pretty good money in 1967. Ms. Good is considered to be a trailblazer for women in real estate, and she says breaking into the club wasn't easy. She was interviewed by Amanda Jones Hoyle. Michelle Rich Good knew of only one other woman working in the Triangle's commercial real estate industry in the early 1980s when she decided to pivot her career path down the same road. I called her up for some advice and she said, good luck breaking into that good old boys club. Today, Good runs one of the largest Raleigh-based tenant and buyer representation firms with a client list that includes companies such as Golden Corral Corporation, Umicore, and Womble, Carlisle, Sandridge, and Rice. She has mentored dozens of women both inside and outside the industry, and she's setting the stage for her own retirement by cultivating new talent. In 2015, her firm, Rich Commercial Realty, celebrates its 25th year in business. TBJ. What would you call the Triangle's commercial real estate industries? Would you call the Triangle's commercial real estate industry a good old boys club? Mrs. Good, women have certainly proven that we can do it. But it's still a test. It's a hard industry to break into, and that hasn't changed. It takes a lot of stamina and work ethic that not everybody has. You still have to prove yourself to your clients, your colleagues, and yourself. Once you have the ability to do that, you can respect yourself and they can respect you. But that's true in any hard industry. It's still male-dominated. But the dinosaurs are getting older, and by virtue of that, there's a generational change. There's a more level playing field now in proven leadership. TBJ, why did you decide to get a real estate license? Mrs. Good, I moved to Raleigh to get a job and worked at Wiley Elementary as a school librarian for 5 years. My dad had a stroke at age 53. I had a graduate degree, so I was making a little more money than some of the other teachers, but it still wasn't much. I started thinking about what I would do if I had to start taking care of my parents, and I knew I didn't want to get another degree, so I got my real estate license. TBJ, you started out selling houses. How did you transition into commercial real estate, and why? Mrs. Good, I'd sold a house to a doctor, and he needed office space. So I talked to my broker about it, and he told me, good luck. I figured out that commercial real estate brokers don't work weekends. I interviewed with 7 companies, and none of them would hire me. I was in the Civitan Club, and one of the members told me that I should talk to Fonville Morrissey, that they were hiring someone for corporate relocation. So I did, and I was calling on companies in RTP. Rex Thomas, then with Highwoods Properties, and I would have breakfast about once a month, and he told me they wanted to hire me. TBJ, you were with Highwoods for 5 years. Why did you leave to start Rich Commercial? Mrs. Good, let's just say it was the right time in my life for a change. TBJ, do you remember who your first client was? Mrs. Good, I sure do. It was Joe Skinner, who was with Greenhorn and O'Meara, an engineering firm that is now Stantec. Joe was in Toastmasters with me. We probably did 6 transactions together over the years. Joe is still a great friend and ally. TBJ, what has been happening more recently at Rich Commercial? Mrs. Good, I must admit that I was in run-out mode about when the last recession hit. We had made the transition to join Keller Williams Commercial, and that didn't quite work out the way I thought it would. I still love the organization and all the people there, but we elected in 2012 to become independent again. About that time, Bo Hargrove and Street Jones came on board as brokers, and they have ignited me in a way I never thought would be possible this far into my career. I haven't been this excited about coming to work in a long time. We're doing transactions now in 13 states. Bo and Street are an amazing team, and we are interested in growing a little more now. TBJ, so have you started talking about retirement? Mrs. Good, oh yes, we already are looking to expand our cabin in Bedford, Virginia. I want to start working some from there. It's only 3 hours away. We have a big garden, a pond, all the way back in the woods. We're 11 miles from the nearest grocery store, but I do want to keep the company sustainable for a long time. We are working to bring these young men in as partners. Whether they'll keep the Rich Commercial name, I don't know. That'll be up to them. We're talking succession planning now, and it's good business to do that. TBJ, where'd you grow up? Mrs. Good, I'm from Garland, down in Sampson County. My father's pharmacy was there. He was also the mayor and head of the school board. Garland's claim to fame is a textile shirt factory that makes Brooks Brothers shirts. If it's not sold in one of the Brooks Brothers outlets, it's sold in Garland, so you can get a nice Brooks Brothers tie there for $14.90. I bought a cashmere sweater there one time for $30. It's the best find in the world. It's a pitiful little town, but it does have Brooks Brothers. TBJ, you like to garden, and you like to shop. What are some of your other hobbies? Mrs. Good, being a librarian, I'm an avid reader. Historic fiction, biographies, war novels, and anything by a Southern writer. I like to hike and walk. I play golf, but my husband Lloyd is a little bit better than I am, and I think I aspire when I retire to take more lessons and to play more golf. This week's Family Business column is by Mr. James Lee. Mr. Lee is a professor at UNC Chapel Hill and a family business speaker, author, and advisor. His column this week is entitled, Help! Advice for Small Business Owners. Question. My son is a fine man, a hard worker, good husband and father, and a real pleasure to be to his mother and me. He's worked in the family-owned printing and graphics business for more than 15 years, long enough for me to know that despite his many qualities, he would not be able to run the business after I retire. But he doesn't realize that, and he's pushing me to draft a plan for him to succeed me. My wife says we should turn the business over to him anyway, since our retirement plan is fully funded. What do you think? Here's Mr. Lee's answer. It sounds like time to get businesslike in planning your company's future. When succession and continuity decisions are made with the heart and not the head, the potential for a bad outcome is enormous. I suggest that you decide clearly on your goals for the business, to continue under family ownership, to provide an income for your son and the employees for a few more years, or some other alternative, and then make a succession choice accordingly. It would be tough initially, but wiser and kinder over the long term, not to give your son a job in which he'll fail. But you can save his feelings and the company too by making your decision in an objective and business-like way. Next question. My sister and I have been bugging our father for years to plan with us about the future of our business. He's over 70 and talks about retiring, but he refuses to talk about keeping the business in the family with my sister and me as co-managers. We're beginning to think there's something wrong with the business and he's hiding it. Are we too suspicious? Here's Mr. Lee's answer. Your father might be hiding something, but not necessarily a serious business problem. Some senior family business owners hesitate to begin succession planning or to bring in expert analysis to assist because they don't want to expose their management style, records, or other particulars to scrutiny and challenge. They're probably not doing anything illegal, but they're running the business their own way, and they don't want to catch a lot of flack for it. You might ease your father's concern by stressing that you and your sister want to learn from his success, not pry into his secrets. Question. I've done everything but stand on my head in a clown suit to get my three children interested in our family's manufacturing company. They've all had summer jobs there as teenagers. I've taken them along to industry conventions, even laid out some tentative plans for them to run the company when I retire. What do I get in response? Blank stares. What am I doing wrong? Here's Mr. Lee's answer. Unless your enthusiasm is coming across as coercive, you're probably not doing anything wrong. A good strategy for marketing the business to the next family generation includes all those approaches. If your children are already married, maybe you're not paying enough attention to getting their spouses on board. Or maybe continuity of family ownership of your company just ain't going to happen. One of the outcomes of effective family business marketing can be clear evidence that your target customers, in this case your children, aren't going to buy it. If that's the case, swallow hard and look at other alternatives. That's a better course than trying to force your kids into roles that will make them unhappy and put the business at serious risk. Final question. A couple of weeks ago, your column recommended using specially experienced family business advisors or consultants to help with some management or succession issues. How can I find those family business specialists? Are they in the Yellow Pages? Here's Mr. Lee's answer. You can check the management consultant section of your phone book, but don't be too disappointed if it doesn't get down to a family business level of specificity. The Family Firm Institute, a professional association, publishes a national family business consultant directory. Contact the Institute at www.ffi.org. This week's edition of the Triangle Business Journal is focused on healthcare heroes. This week, we will only be talking about the Lifetime Achievement Award, and this column is written by the editor of the magazine, Mr. Sukhadar Mukherjee. From pediatrics to community care, Urban Ministries' Peter Morris wins Healthcare Lifetime Achievement Award. Dr. Peter Morris will say that his career has come full circle. Now the director of Urban Ministries of Wake County, Morris is actually on his fourth career. After graduating from UNC School of Medicine, Morris worked as a pediatrician in rural Kentucky. While there, he quickly learned that caring for children truly means caring for a community. He says he had an almost simplistic idea of his job when he first became a pediatrician. He thought he was going to take care of children. And, of course, you realize that you can't take care of a child without taking care of their parents. So I suddenly began to realize that I wasn't really in the child business. I was in the family business, and then I was in the extended family business, and then the community business, he says. So my career as a physician moved me from pediatrics to public health to thinking about a whole community worth of individuals. Morris returned to UNC to learn more. He earned credentials in public health, maternal and infant health, communicable disease, clean food and water, and more. He worked as a medical director at Wake County Human Services and earned a Master's of Divinity from Duke University. While working in public health, Morris says he liked the work the agency did, but his work was all for populations of people, and he didn't feel like he was doing anything for an individual. Going to Duke to get a Master's in Divinity was a way to think about people as people, he says. While with Wake County, we did a lot of good work for health, but it was for teens, 15 to 19-year-olds. Here, it's an actual person who's 18 years old whose face I can remember. When you come here, you come to see a real person with a real problem. Nothing abstract. That's why he says he's come full circle, starting his career for individual children, caring them, moving to caring for populations, and now coming back to see individuals. As part of his mission at Urban Ministries, Morris is working to expand on its uses for the letter H. Traditionally, Urban Ministries has viewed its goals as focusing on healthcare, hunger, and homelessness. Morris wants to add a heart to that list as a critical fourth component. By enabling 1,500 volunteers from our community to engage face-to-face with their neighbors, one helping the other, and both gaining and growing from the experience. Morris is showing us how to build a community that loves and cares for itself. Neighbors making a community healthier for neighbors, says Whitney White Zenner, a member of the Urban Ministries Board. Mr. Morris was interviewed by the Triangle Business Journal, and this is what follows. TBJ, what motivates you in your work every day? Mr. Morris, the people I am privileged to work with and for, the clients, staff, volunteers, and board. Rather than say we have a good team, I believe we have a good culture. Culture is more inclusive and suggests that we share what we believe and how we do it with everyone in the workplace and community. TBJ, what are your chief responsibilities? Mr. Morris, I think my role is to recognize and promote talent and insight among staff, volunteers, and clients. It's to be well-read, well-connected, and curious to see who is doing what and where that might make a difference to our clients. I once thought that my personal goal, and therefore work plan, was to change the hearts and minds of Wake County. But that's pretty egocentric. There are great people in this generous county who could and might do more for our neighbors and community if we could see better with our eyes, hear with our ears, and lend not only our hands to help, but our hearts and our minds. TBJ, what do you enjoy most about what you do? Mr. Morris, listening and learning and framing and reframing. TBJ, what do you consider some of your major accomplishments? Mr. Morris, anything I've been fortunate enough to do has been because there were great staff who believed in what we wanted to do. TBJ, how does your work impact patients and others in the healthcare community? Mr. Morris, the fun of moving to Urban Ministries has been the opportunity to grab a more broad definition of health. It's not just primary care or public health, but community health. It's not just medicine and population-based care. It's nutrition, housing, stress reduction, and timely crisis response. Health has always meant physical, mental, emotional, and spiritual health. And Urban Ministries addresses all of these domains. Most of us think the health is health care, the way we examine someone in a clinic, make a diagnosis, and prescribe a treatment. But more and more, it isn't the health care that is important, but the outcomes. Health. Counting visits and lab tests and prescriptions just shows we're busy. Measuring both quantitative and qualitative improvement in health, The numbers and the feelings show that people do get better. And getting better means living life more fully at work, at home, and in the community. More people miss less work, use emergency rooms less, and are admitted to the hospital less as well. More people say they feel healthy. TBJ. If you could change one thing about healthcare, what would it be? Mr. Morris. There's been a shift in how we talk about things, and we need to keep moving along that path, from compliance, which implies it's about policing health, to adherence, which makes it seem an issue of motivation, to partnering, where both clinician and client give and take to create a plan both can live with, to relationship, where we better understand each other's goals and efforts, foilables, and strength. TBJ, why did you choose healthcare for a career? Mr. Morris, I majored in history and humanities but took enough science to qualify for medical school. I applied early admission to only one school, UNC, and maybe I was making it harder to get in, but UNC accepted me. It wasn't the choice to study medicine that was important. It was the choice to do as well as I can, day after day, that matters. TBJ, what do you do to relax and have fun? Mr. Morris, I read, run, play guitar, watch movies, enjoy time with my wife, she's a great cook, and eat well and enjoy living with 9 indoor rescue cats. TBJ, what do you like most about living in the Triangle? Mr. Morris, I moved here 40 years ago and have never regretted it. A mixture of the people and the place. There are other nice places to live, but it's the people who I've met here make it home. This week's editorial and opinion page has a guest columnist. That is Mr. John Hood, who is the chairman of the John Locke Foundation in Raleigh. His column is entitled, Newsflash, Taxes Matter. If North Carolina's tax burden has no effect on business decisions and the performance of the economy, as left-of-center politicians and editorialists have repeatedly insisted, then why are they so enamored with targeted tax breaks? Governor Pat McCrory and many Republicans in the North Carolina General Assembly are currently pushing legislation to expand or restore various tax credits for economic development. I don't agree with their choice of means. I prefer uniform taxation levied as low, flat, marginal rates on broad tax bases. But at least they have the right goal in mind. To reduce the costs that governments impose on businesses, I can't say the same for many of their ideological foes. For years, Democrats and liberals have denied that taxes have a significant effect on state competitiveness. They attacked the Republican-led legislature in 2011 when it refused to extend sales and income taxes first imposed by then-Governor Bev Perdue and the previously Democratic General Assembly. 2 years later, McCrory and the legislature enacted a sweeping tax reform bill that reduced North Carolina's tax burden by hundreds of millions of dollars a year. Again, the left cried foul. In both cases, Republicans argue that North Carolina's economy would prosper by lowering the cost of government, by reducing taxes and reorienting revenue to the state's highest priorities. They were on solid empirical ground. But taxes aren't the only element in the economic story, of course. Because modern economics require the provision of certain public services, some level of state taxation produces net economic benefits. The real debate is not between two camps of primitives grunting government good and government bad under their collective breaths. Rather, the debate is about locating the point at which the cost of government, taxes, exceeds the value of public services. Now to the incentives question. While some Democrats have maintained intellectual consistency about taxes, Others are now arguing that while across-the-board tax cuts are useless, North Carolina can enhance its business climate and economic growth by doubling down on tax credits, closing funds, and other incentive programs. I suppose the idea here is that state politicians have wasted recent tax cuts on unworthy companies that either didn't need or didn't merit them, but that if they would just exercise more discretion, they could cut taxes on the right companies while keeping taxes higher on the wrong ones. I prefer across-the-board tax reduction to targeted tax incentives, not only because I have read many academic studies, but also because I have met many politicians. I may respect and like them, but I don't consider them superhuman. We have another guest column this week. This column is written by Brian Bukowski. Mr. Bukowski is a partner and co-founder at Jobian Consulting, an Atlanta, Georgia-based consulting firm. His column is entitled, How to Avoid Value-Draining M&A Pitfalls. As the recovery from the 2008 financial crisis continues, the year ahead is forecast to bring more economic ups than downs. This will likely give companies more confidence in riding the mergers and acquisitions roller coaster. In fact, since 2009, M&A activity has made a steady climb. Truly, a solid business strategy, M&A activity can fall short on delivery of the promised business value if it's not managed from start to finish. In a national survey of M&A executives, our firm found that 93% of respondents said 60% of U.S. merger or acquisitions failed to successfully return a positive value over the long haul. That shocking stat means that only 40% of mergers and acquisitions succeed. It's for this reason corporate executives need solid and sound business advice on best practices to avoid succumbing to value-draining M&A pitfalls. Through research and experience, Jobian has identified 11 value-draining pitfalls that threaten every merger and acquisition. While these can happen before, during, and after the closing of the deal, the five that are especially damaging occur during the integration phase after the deal is closed. They're easy to sidestep if you know they lie ahead. The five pitfalls to avoid are 1. Poor communication. With 72% of those surveyed indicating poor communication is very likely to be a pitfall, executives and companies should seek to over-communicate after the close of any deal. If you don't have an update, it's okay to let your organization know that's the case. In doing so, you squash rumors and maintain honesty. Also, be sure to communicate to the right people. Find employee influencers and address concerns and fears of the organization early. This leverages core change management principles and ensures internal communications and will be stronger and lead to less confusion or dissension. 2. Loss of executive focus. Focus is essential during a deal. Executives must resist the temptation to become enamored with the new integration. They have to continue to exercise business maturity and discipline to keep the newly formed company driving forward. Both are needed to ensure the proper prioritization to deliver on the business goals and shareholder expectations. 3. Unclear expectations. Missing or having unclear expectations was seen by 44% of those valued as very likely to drain value from any deal. A failure to clearly document expectations increases the likelihood that they will be missed or, worse yet, completely misunderstood. One way to ensure your organization isn't left scrambling to fix an integration that's gone sideways is to establish a tiger team at the front end of any integration. These individuals should not be pulled together when a problem arises. Rather, they should be involved from the get-go as resources that can help at a moment's notice. Number 4 pitfall, no well-defined definition of success. Having and expressing a sharp vision of business success for the combined organization is a must. If things get bad, your team will focus almost 100% on tactics instead of remembering the rationale around the original business case that drove the merger. By grounding your team with the core business case behind the new organization, you greatly minimize the potential for dissension or disillusion. And finally, number 5, unforeseen surprises not covered in due diligence. Though it may be difficult to plan for the unexpected, creating an overlap between the due diligence and implementation teams helps considerably. The teams should overlap for a minimum of 3 weeks to ensure the two groups have time to collaborate. When a due diligence team simply throws work over the wall to the integration team, they can move on to the next deal. You are playing with fire. Armed with the right knowledge, executives can overcome common pitfalls and enjoy uncommon business returns. Just remember to communicate early and often. Remain focused on the task ahead. Paint a clear picture of your expectations, define success, and prepare for at least one unforeseen surprise. You should know that the healing powers of a winning chef made quite the news. The Single Elimination Cooking Battle, part of the Gotta Be NC Competition Dining Series, has come to an end. On March 6th, the final battle paired Southern Seasons chef Kurt Chelvey of Kurt's Cucina against Chef Ryan Conklin of Rex Hospital. Yeah, you heard that right. A chef from a local hospital made it past 15 other local culinary experts to compete in the final battle. The chefs had not one but two secret ingredients for the evening, cheese and certified Angus beef. After the crumbs settled and all the votes were accounted for, Chef Ryan Conklin won the coveted Red Chef's jacket, $2,000 cash, and a handmade chef knife by Iron Man Forge. And there's icing on the cake. Conklin is also a winner of the Triangle Business Journal's Healthcare Hero Award. Good for you, Chef. We've run out of time for today's edition of the Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Al Reynolds, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program will be available online at triangleReadingService.org immediately after the broadcast. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. So long until next time.